This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 23rd, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. The country's most secretive court says the FBI has repeatedly lied. The Pakistani president amends the constitution to give himself sweeping new powers. And in New York, Mayor Bloomberg opens an old jail to house the homeless. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Rob Manning with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The World Summit for Sustainable Development is set to begin in Johannesburg, South Africa, but dissent in the city is already being quashed. Naeem Jina is there.
Johannesburg is abuzz as delegates for the World Summit on Sustainable Development stream in to make up the 50,000 people expected for the summit, the Global People's Forum, and anti-WSSD activities. Today saw the official opening of the NGO summit amid fanfare and with a speech by South African President Thabo Mbeki. But the celebration masked growing discontent among many South Africans about the way the government is dealing with people's responses to the WSSD. Security forces are denying the organizers of two marches, one being organized by the ANC and its alliance partners, permission to use the route they want and to march from the poverty-stricken Alexandra Township to Sandton, the venue of the WSSD. Sandton is the South African symbol of opulence and inequality and has now become a virtual fortress. 2 days ago, 72 members and leaders of the Landless People's Movement were arrested at a legal demonstration. It's just been announced that the thousands of participants at the teach-in will also march to the Johannesburg Central Police Station to demand the release of activists arrested in the past few days. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naeem Jina in Johannesburg.
Israeli officials said today that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's scheduled trip to Florida next month has been postponed. Sally Watt reports from St. Petersburg.
Word of the delay in Sharon's plans to visit Florida came after sharp criticism from Democrats that the trip was an attempt to help Republican governor and presidential brother Jeb Bush in his reelection campaign. The two leaders were scheduled to appear together in Miami Beach on September 9th, one day before Florida's primary election for Democratic candidate for governor. Sharon was traveling to Florida as a guest of the Greater Miami Jewish Federation. Israeli officials say politics had nothing to do with the decision to delay the trip. They cite security concerns and Sharon's domestic budget battles. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
A Palestinian professor deported from the U.S. is in the Middle East today, but it is uncertain if any country has accepted him. On Monday, Free Speech Radio News reported that former University of South Florida instructor Mays al-Najjar, who had been held in solitary confinement for the past 8 months for overstaying his student visa and previously had been jailed for over 3.5 years on allegations of terrorist associations, had finally secured a travel document and a visa so he could be deported to an unnamed Middle Eastern country. But it appears those plans have gone awry. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
According to his brother-in-law, suspended South Florida professor Sami Al-Arian, Mazen al-Najjar was barred from landing in Bahrain this morning and was sent to another country. Al-Najjar was on a charter U.S. military flight when Bahrain refused to allow the plane to land. A secretary for the Bahrain embassy in Washington told the St. Petersburg Times today that the two-week visa al-Najjar obtained was intended for ordinary people who want to visit the tiny Middle Eastern country. But the official said that al-Najjar's case is not ordinary, and because of that, Bahrain will not allow him to enter. Yesterday, family members said al-Najjar had finally left the correctional facility he had been held at for the last 8 months to leave for an unnamed Middle Eastern country. But they remained silent on which country he was being deported to until he arrived safely. Those fears now appear to be justified. The U.S. government held al-Najjar in jail for over 3.5 years because of secret evidence that he had ties to terrorism, but they never charged him with a crime. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says thousands are being forced to flee in Colombia as conflict intensifies following President Álvaro Uribe's inauguration. Susan Wood has more from the U.N.
A spokesperson for the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees today appealed to all sides in Colombia's civil war to respect the rights of civilians and the security of relief workers. The refugee agency, known as UNHCR, said it was extremely concerned about the thousands of Colombians, most of them women and children, driven from their homes in recent weeks by renewed fighting or threats from illegal armed groups. An estimated 2 million people have already been displaced since 1995. UNHCR also expressed concern about a spillover of abductions and kidnappings into neighboring Venezuela and Ecuador. Human rights advocates say more civilians may become targets under new President Alvaro Uribe's plan, announced yesterday, to arm 15,000 poor farmers with U.S. and European-made weapons in violation of international law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
This is Rob Manning for Free Speech Radio News.
Civil libertarians' worst fears were confirmed late yesterday when the country's most secretive court issued its first ever public opinion. The top-secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court says the FBI has repeatedly lied to the court when it wants permission to do electronic surveillance and home invasions. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
For only the second time in its 24 years, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court rejected an FBI request for permission to snoop on suspected foreign agents. The court used the opportunity to scold the Justice Department for, quote, clearly trying to thwart the will of Congress. The FISA court, as it's known, found former FBI Director Louis Freeh gave false information to the court to get permission for a wiretap during the Clinton years. Here's Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights in D.C.
It's a remarkable opinion, obviously. It just really blows open the door on that court in a way that's amazing to me, particularly considering that those are the same judges that approved 20,000-some wiretaps or 15,000-some wiretaps in a 20-year period. And now all of a sudden there's a recognition that those wiretaps are being misused to make criminal cases against people in the United States when they have no business doing that.
Congress established the secret court in 1978 to keep presidents from unilaterally approving surveillance on foreign nationals. Since then, wiretaps and home invasions on suspected foreign agents have been approved by a rotating panel of judges. But legal experts say in 24 years, the FISA court has only rejected two requests for a wiretap. And since the whole process is secret, the judgments are made in a sealed room at the Justice Department. Jonathan Turley says there's no deterrent. Formerly with the National Security Agency, Turley has appeared before the FISA court himself.
Under FISA, you'll never know that your privacy was invaded. You'll never know that someone came into your house, scrubbed your computer, wired your house. And so if the government was abusive, if there was no really any evidence at all that you were involved in these types of activities, those agents will never be held accountable. It creates an atmosphere that in which abuse can occur.
According to the opinion the FISA court released yesterday, justice and FBI officials knowingly gave bad information to the court in more than 75 applications for warrants and wiretaps over the past 2 years. The court found the feds also gave information gleaned from their surveillance to authorities in criminal cases at least 4 times. That violates basic constitutional protections. Michael Ratner again.
Even before this, what we feared when they allowed this foreign surveillance court to start functioning was that it would, every bit that prosecutors would start to use that in criminal cases rather than keep it confined to intelligence cases. And that apparently is what's actually started to happen.
Ratner says the FISA court is clearly trying to tell Attorney General John Ashcroft to cool off. The so-called Patriot Act passed after 9/11 makes it easier to get permission to do surveillance on foreign nationals. The court has ordered Ashcroft to relax some of those new regulations. The Department of Justice is appealing the case. The appeal proceedings are to be conducted in secret. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf announced a set of constitutional reforms earlier this week that would give him sweeping new powers. On the back of the recent referendum Musharraf held to allow himself another 5-year rule, and just over a month before the October national elections, the once military general has solidified his role as president with what some are calling dictatorial powers. Under Musharraf's reforms, all the political and economic policies introduced by him this week will not require validation by parliament. In a press conference, the president said his reforms were irreversible, and the new parliament, to be elected in October, will have no power to change them. In fact, he said, the changes were aimed at ensuring the parliament did not attempt to derail any of his policies.
They better perform for Pakistan. Now, if they start to start attacking me or politicking or intriguing and leaving governance aside and again taking the country down, the authority is there to sort them out. They will not be allowed to do it.
While the White House initially said they were extremely worried about the constitutional changes, President Bush yesterday said the United States will maintain its anti-terrorism alliance with Pakistan, despite moves by the Pakistani president to expand his authority. However, this level of power is extremely worrying to many within Pakistan. I.A. Rehman, director of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, says the Pakistani military cannot be trusted at all, and that it's the people of Pakistan who will bear the brunt of Musharraf's new powers.
As far as the people here are concerned, they have had a taste of military government from 1958 to 1969 and from 1977 to 1988. And in these years, Pakistan's problems were aggravated. Whatever the role the government of Pakistan might have played on the external scene, domestically, the people have paid a very heavy price.
Yet representatives and supporters of Musharraf say the government needs the expanded powers to ensure democracy. Abida Hussain is the former Pakistani ambassador to the United States.
In Pakistan's interest at the moment, it may be fruitful to seek to make an entente with military authority on the part of the political community. And if we can indeed cooperate with each other in managing the affairs of the government, it could probably bring the people of Pakistan some modicum of reasonable governance.
Raymond says the constitutional changes and the placing of a military chief as president is anything but democratic.
I mean, when the referendum was held, it was said, no, it is just a consultation and the election will be decided. Now he says that I have received a mandate and I am president for 5 years. And I will also remain chief of army staff for 5 years. So this concentration of power in a single person has not done good anywhere in the world. And I am myself intrigued when people ask me, what's wrong with that? As if we are living in the Middle Ages.
And as for the visit to Pakistan of U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage tomorrow, Musharraf supporters are clear that it will not impact the country's moves to military rule. Former U.S. Ambassador Hussain again.
I don't think that President Musharraf is going to pay much heed to the United States commenting on whether he can or cannot make constitutional amendments. Well, I suspect he'll say to General Armitage, Mr. Richard Armitage, not so long ago, President Bush may have said to him, which is that he'll say, are you with me or are you against me?
Armitage is currently in India, where the Indian government is denying Pakistani accusations this morning of an air attack on a Pakistani military post in Kashmir. Armitage arrives in Islamabad tomorrow. President Bush's visit to Portland, Oregon, turned to chaos when over 1,200 protesters, including children, were attacked by riot police with pepper spray and rubber bullets. From Portland, Andrew Stelzer has this report.
George Bush sucks! George Bush sucks! George Bush sucks!
To mark the president's visit to Portland, some 1,200 demonstrators came out to protest Bush and his administration's foreign and environmental policies. Bush was in town to speak at a fundraiser for Senator Gordon Smith. 350 guests paid $1,000 each to attend the reception. Over 40 people paid $25,000 apiece for a picture with the president. Earlier in the day, Bush announced his new forest management plan, which would make it easier for timber companies to log in national forests. Protesters outside the hotel criticized the president's so-called Healthy Forest Initiative, along with several other of the administration's policies, including the Free Trade Area of the Americas and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
I'm here to support all the Americans that can see through Bush's administration and how he's feeling, one, about war. What he's really after is big business. Keeping the oil, that's his only reason for wanting to go into Iraq. It has nothing to do with terrorism.
The protesters blocked the streets surrounding the Hilton. Although they remained peaceful and did not cross any of the metal barricades, riot police moved in with rubber bullets, pepper spray, and tear gas.
And you got to realize that they had us right where they wanted us. We weren't near the building. We were like a block and a half away. The crowd was contained and nobody was going anywhere. And neither were the cops. The cops weren't doing anything either. And then all of a sudden, here comes the spray.
The protest brought together a broad coalition of community groups and people of all ages. Don Jokin brought his three children.
We were engaging in peaceful protest. We were at the back of a group, walking with our kids in a backpack, carrying our children, not up in the front, not at any barricades or anything. The police ringed off all four sides, trapping everybody in the intersection. We were scared. We told the police in front of us, we said, hey, look, we just need to get out of here with our kids. He pulled out his can of spray and sprayed my wife and kid from 2 feet, maybe, and sprayed me at an angle from maybe 3 or 4 feet away, got me in this eye and my three-year-old son, got my wife and my 10-month-old baby.
The protest continued past dark, and police used more pepper spray as the evening progressed. The actions of the Portland police were reminiscent of May Day 2000, when non-lethal devices were used on a rally. Since then, police behavior had become less confrontational. Civil rights advocates are already threatening lawsuits and calling for the resignation of Portland's police chief. For Free Speech Radio News, from Portland, Oregon, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
More than 8,400 families in New York City need shelter. That's the largest number of homeless people in the city's recorded history. Cutbacks made to affordable housing programs during the Giuliani administration, combined with a bad economy, has created a significant overflow of families without shelters. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has responded to the overflow by opening up a 64-year-old city jail in the Bronx to be used as a shelter. But lawsuits and the threat of toxic lead paint within the facility plague the short-term housing solution. From New York City, Jeff Brady has this report.
If you're in need of shelter in New York City, you'll be directed to the Bronx Emergency Assistance Unit, or EAU. It's the only entry point in the five boroughs to obtain shelter. In the past 2 months, the number of homeless families has increased by 25%, forcing the EAU to work round the clock to process and accommodate the demand. A long-standing court order forbids the homeless to sleep on the floors of the EAU, but at times, some families like Michelle Pearson and her two children have no other choice.
I had to sleep in there all night. Rats in there, it's roaches in there, it's mice in there. I mean, it's nasty in there. So would you want to live there with your children, having the chance for a rat to bite them, roaches to bite you? Because I don't know what this is that bit me.
Where?
On my leg. You know? It's just... it's really stressful.
Pearson waits outside the EAU with her two children until her family is placed in a temporary shelter. She says she'd rather be outside than sitting in an unclean holding room around hundreds of people yelling.
And anybody can walk off the street in there. It's not clean. It's not sanitized. It's not... you can catch anything in there.
Mommy, my
uncle. Okay. I have no place to go. I lost everything. My furniture, everything. Everything I've ever owned, I've lost. And I just pray.
There are other families like Pearson's that linger in open fields across the street from the EAU building, waiting to be placed. In order to get some of these families out of the intake center, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg decided to house the overflow of homeless families in an unused jail just blocks away. Surrounded by razor wire and run by correctional officers, the Bronx House of Detention for Men will be used as a temporary housing. Nearly 100 families will stay in dormitory-style barracks with 28 beds per room and showering in groups. Since the municipality decided to use the jail as a homeless shelter, advocates for the homeless are taking the administration to court. Other problems, such as the discovery of lead paint inside the jail and the risk to children under 6, has added to the embarrassment of what critics call a hasty decision. Pat Basil, Legal Aid's Director of Public Information, says disease can spread rapidly among children in a barrack-style setting. And this week, a judge ruled that the city must make the necessary changes by the end of the month.
There's high levels of lead there. I think that most of us would agree that we do not want to in any way endanger children and the medically frail with high levels of lead. Also, a jail is not a proper facility for infants, pregnant women, children. It's not for homeless families.
My assessment was that the clients could enter in a way that did not feel as if they were going into a jail.
Linda Gibbs, commissioner of the Department of Homeless Services, says the city still plans to use the old jail once the walls and beams are painted and tested.
When the issue was brought to our attention, we immediately discontinued placing young children there. The lead is an issue for children who are 6 years or younger, and we immediately tested at the same time. We're now remediating, encapsulating the existing painted surfaces with a HUD-approved remediation process, and that will allow this facility to be safely used again for younger children.
New York City is the only jurisdiction in America where it's mandated to shelter homeless families once their eligibility is determined. Many sleep at the EAU for at least a week before they get placed in a shelter. Gibbs says, given the choice, she'd rather have children waking up in jail than sleeping on the benches and floors at the intake office. Charlie was homeless for half a year. He says the idea of staying in a prison for shelter will have a psychological effect on him.
You look at the windows, all bars, they're in jail. I'm homeless, I need help, I'm asleep, I wake up in the morning, I'm in jail. If someone comes to visit you inside, you're going to a prison visiting room with prison bars, prison gates, and prison locks. Homeless people are not prisoners. They are unfortunate people who have a downfall in life that need help to get on their feet. And this system is full of shit, and it's not working for anyone.
Meanwhile, the Bloomberg administration is eyeing the Skyway Motel in Queens as a long-term shelter solution. Gibbs says the building has 49 units with efficiencies and can be used as ongoing shelter placements for homeless families. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
Australia will this weekend mark the first anniversary of the Tampa crisis when the Howard government refused to allow a Norwegian freighter to deliver asylum seekers it had rescued. If not for the captain's determination to ensure the well-being of the 438 Afghan, Iraqi and Palestinian refugees, the Tampa incident may have just become another blip in the litany of Canberra's human rights abuses of asylum seekers. And as Michael Bushell reports from Sydney, a United Nations delegation recently took a tour of the Woomera detention facility in the South Australian desert with interesting results.
A recent United Nations-sponsored tour of the Woomera Immigration Detention Centre, situated in South Australia, labelled Australia's treatment of asylum seekers as degrading and appealed for a more humanitarian approach. In turn, the government's Minister for Immigration, Philip Ruddock, said the tour and report, led by Justice Prafulla Chandra Bhagwati, a regional advisor to the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, was emotive and flawed. According to Mr. Ruddock, the UN's one-day tour of Woomera was too brief, and he accused Justice Bhagwati of listening too much to refugee advocates. Chris Sidoti is a former Federal Human Rights Commissioner.
It's never possible to listen too much. Certainly it's not possible to listen too much to those who are most seriously affected by human rights violations. So talking to asylum seekers, those in detention, those who are being granted temporary visas, would be the most critical part of the mission of any organisation looking at human rights violations in relation to asylum seekers. Justice Bhagwati, however, also spoke to the Foreign Minister, the Immigration Minister, the Attorney General, and had, as I understand it, almost a full day with officials of the Immigration Department. So if there is any criticism, perhaps the criticism could be made that he listened too much to the government's point of view.
The government's point of view is the numbers of arrivals of asylum seekers are on the rise, and if mandatory detention was abolished, the floodgates would open. Dr. Penny Matthews is an expert in international law from the Australian National University in Canberra, and is not so confident about the legality of the department's immigration policy. Mandatory detention of asylum seekers without regard for individual circumstance equates to arbitrary detention, and with the recent admission from Minister Ruddock that detention policy does indeed serve as a deterrent, Matthews says this adds weight to the argument Australia is breaching international law. But as Penny Matthews says, getting the government to say so much is unlikely.
The problem challenging the detention policy within Australia has been that many international laws are not properly implemented. In Australian domestic law, there was a High Court challenge to the detention legislation when it was first brought in, and that was largely unsuccessful. At the international level, it's possible to go off to bodies like the Human Rights Committee. The problem is that's been done, and the government tends to disregard the findings of UN bodies.
While some commentators now say the electorate is shifting its position on the detention of children, the government maintains families should be kept together above all else, and releasing whole families of asylum seekers would give incentive to further arrivals. Chris Sidoti of the Human Rights Council disputes this.
A family should be kept together. The department is quite right about that. But that's not an excuse for keeping children locked up and indeed keeping families locked up. The better system is the one that human rights law requires. It requires individual assessment of the need to detain. There may be some people who do need to be detained, people who, for example, pose some security risk to Australia or some risk to public safety or public health. If they have children, that needs to be taken into account. I mean, it depends upon the extent of the risk. Certainly, it would take a very grave risk, very, very grave risk, to justify the detention of children.
When federal parliament meets again in mid-August, opposition parties in the Senate are expected to lobby hard for abolition of detention of children. But it's just as likely from the government's response to the UN report that detention policies will remain. Penny Matthews.
It is commonly said that Australia has the harshest detention policy in the Western world. We really do detain just about everyone for the duration of the determination of their status. There is absolutely no consideration of whether it might be appropriate for people to live in the community, whether they're likely to abscond, whether they pose a threat to national security and so on.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Michael Bushell in Sydney.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, and Jade Padgett-Seekins is our technical producer. We have technical assistance from Pauline Bartolone, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelly, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Scott Gurian in New Jersey, and I report for Free Speech Radio News because it's the best hard-hitting alternative news source on the radio. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.